Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Koreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Eka mawe o mo Nissan Bolivinaka, whakalawala yatu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We're coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol, and it is a privilege to be spending the morning with you. Coming up, violent clashes between students and members of the public in Goroka PNG has left more than 50 people injured.
There were arguments between the local community, the Aspis people and students, and then there was a confrontation, and then after that, the students mobilized and they came down and fight with the community there. And then the community, the local Aspis, will retaliate again, and then that's how the situation went.
Also, Climate Conference, or COP30, is underway, but with a notable absence of Pacific leaders. It's known as the Red Pigeon. Nope, not a bird, but a plane giving life-saving service to those in Vanuatu.
We are very, very, very happy to welcoming back to our Red Pigeon after so long.
And the role and action of human rights across the region gets the spotlight at this year's 30th Asia-Pacific Forum. All that and more here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. But first, one of Papua New Guinea's largest universities has been shut down after violent clashes between students and members of the public left more than 50 people injured. Thankfully, no deaths. Police have ramped up security around the University of Goroka in the Eastern Highlands following the outbreak of violence. Officers from surrounding urban centres were called in to help restore order after tensions between students and locals escalated into widespread unrest. Max Gotti, a long-time Goroka resident, told Pacific Beat's Godwin Icky that it's unclear how the violence started.
At this stage, the report, the investigation is ongoing, and we yet to establish the real cause of the incident. There's some rumors that it happened in around some drunkards. There were arguments between the local community, the Aspis people, and students, and then there was a confrontation. And then after that, the students mobilized and they came down and fight with the community there. And then the community, the local Aspis, will retaliate again, and then that's how the situation went out of control.
The situation, is it still tense? What's the situation like the moment on the ground?
It's now on the ground. It's stable. Police presence are here. Police from Kundiawa and Hagen and Jiwaka and our local police from Goroka. They've managed to maintain the situation and it's under calm now. Our minister from higher education, Hamabur Kiluka, is here. He was here yesterday and monitoring the situation after 6 o'clock. I mean, the matters in the school council and all the students at EOG. So I think situation is under control now.
And do we have any casualties? Do we have any injuries, both from, you know, the locals in the area and the students?
There's more than, let me confirm, 70 or 80 students that have been injured. Both, I think, 45 or 43 something locals and a police officer. Who has been injured.
This sort of incidents, especially in Goroka and, you know, UOG, this is not the first time this has happened. It's always happened in the past.
There's quite a low number of such incidents that happened. This one would be the 10th or the 4th one. Sometimes, you know, it comes back, it reflects back to our leader and also to the council, the school council, and, you know, there has to be some disciplinary actions taken.
Now, I know you're talking about alcohol, but does the university have like zero tolerance on alcohol consumption?
Like I said, it comes back to the management and the school council. They have to be strict. They have to implement that zero tolerance of alcohol. And I'm not sure whether, you know, they're up to date and they're implementing that policy.
The government services still ongoing, or has everything been, you know, shut down for safety reasons? You know, school students, workers, and of course, university staff as well.
This is usual for the CBD. in town area, operation is normal, business are open, families are running, taxis are operating, school students in that part of the province, it is normal, except for UOG. The whole entire school is on shutdown right now. After assessing the situation and the investigation, we will know the outcome, whether, you know, we have the end of the year for the academic year for the students, and also we have the exams coming up, so that might affect them, but like I said, it will depend on the outcome of the situation after they do the investigation, assess the situation, and then also assess the casualties from both sides, the local and the students, and from there they will do a comprehensive report based on this investigation, and we will hear what school council will say, and the minister and our leaders will say to whether to close this academic year or to continue and let the student continue with the exam and close off this academic year.
We've also heard that Western Islands Governor Wairapa is planning on removing his students. Are you aware of that?
Not only Governor Wairapa. I saw a statement from Honorable Alan Pett, the governor for ACP, and also a member for Yogru Sausia, Honorable Richard Laru. I was just reading the statement. They were calling on their students to have them repatriated back to the provinces. Like I said, it depends. The Goroka itself here, the surrounding community, they condemn this action. And this action started from only two or few people, and it's a disgrace to the whole entire province.
And that there is Max Gotti, Goroka resident, speaking there to ABC's Godwin Eki. Pacific Beat. Now to Timor-Leste, where there is a small fishing village of Biyako, 3 hours from Dili, was once surrounded by vital mangroves and coral reefs. It's known as the Coral Triangle, one of the most diverse marine areas in the world, with local communities in Biyako actively participating in preserving their marine environment through traditional and modern conservation practices. But today, the threat of climate change and human activity is putting the area at risk. Timor-Leste reporter Vanya Vieira visited the village to find out how they're fighting back.
...32-year-old, Anibal da Purificação has been a fisherman in Biyako since his teenage years. And over the years, he noticed change in his community.
Claro que...
Obviously, fish in the past and now are not the same due to climate change. We can say that the ecosystem has changed compared to before. In the past, fish farming was better than it is now. Climate change has made it more difficult to catch good fish and species.
Anibal believes it is harder to find big fish because many coral reefs in the area have been damaged, forcing fishermen to change their methods.
In the past, fishermen could use small nets to catch fish, which yielded a modest or large quantity. However, nowadays, only some of our friends with large nets can catch many fish, providing sufficient income for their families.
Romeo Eclides Maya, field assistant for marine protection at Conservation International Timor-Leste, told ABC that the Coral Triangle area has been hit by climate change and impact from human activity.
Climate change is like a tidal wave, and human behavior affecting the reef includes practices such as mothers taking coral to mix with beetle chewing and bringing iron to cut charcoal for cooking.
According to Romeo, during the Indonesian era, fishermen also used bombs to catch fish, which caused damage to the coral reefs.
But they didn't realize that the structure underneath were also being broken. The bombs were not used in one specific place. Their target areas included not only Biyako to Batugede, but most fishermen employed bombs in various places as well.
Now, to protect coral reefs and mangrove, the Biyako community is going back to the past. It has started using what's known as a traditional Tarabandu ritual, a traditional Timorese customary law that involves collective agreement to prohibit destructive fishing methods, protect spawning sites, and limiting coral extraction during critical periods.
Tarabandu will benefit the communities in Biyako village in the future.
Sergio Pedruco is a ritual leader in Biyako. he implements Tarabandu to protect coral reefs and mangroves.
If we do not protect the environment, our future may disappear. With this in mind, we invited the entire community and the leaders of the traditional house in Biako. I explained to them that our community must implement Tarabandu. If we don't do so, our children will suffer.
Sergio says now, with Tarabandu, they are starting to see change. The day hope will continue for years to come.
Now, fish are starting to return because it helps protect the coral.
We established Tarabandu laws for communities not to fish along the coast, not to damage the marine environment such as reefs, seaweed and others, and make a better marine ecosystem for the future.
And that is Sergio Petruku in Biakau, ending that report from Vonia Vieira in Timor-Leste.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Raiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fatsalo Fatsu and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, day one of the COP30 UN climate talks is underway in the city of Belém in Brazil. This year's climate talks is of special significance, marking 10 years since the Paris Agreement was signed. Thousands of foreign delegates are there, including Pacific officials, as developing countries apply pressure on industrial nations to commit to reducing carbon emissions. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has issued a rallying call for the world to commit to limiting global warming.
The hard truth is that we have failed to ensure we remain below 1.5 degrees. Science now tells us that the temporary overshoot between the 1.5 limit, starting at the latest in the early 2030s, is inevitable. We need a paradigm shift to limit this overshoot's magnitude and duration and quickly drive it down. Even a temporary overshoot will have dramatic consequences. It could push ecosystems past irreversible tipping points, expose billions to unlivable conditions, and amplify threats to peace and security. Every fraction of a degree means more hunger, displacement, and loss, especially for those least responsible.
But a big difference to this year's gathering has been the lack of Pacific leaders at the event. Now, this comes as the US withdraws from the Paris Agreement, with President Donald Trump calling climate change a hoax. While on the line with us from Belém is the head of Greenpeace Pacific, Shiva Gandan. I believe it's just after five there in Belém, so good afternoon, Shiva.
It's 5:15 here.
Here we go. Well, Shiva, look, thank you for joining us. Could you sort of really just share with us, describe the atmosphere there in Belém, even the city itself? Because I know we hear there's like thousands of foreign delegates there in the city.
Yeah, Belém is actually extremely beautiful. And this city in the Amazon, I think, has been waiting to host this conference for the world. However, there has been a few concerns actually with the struggle to complete the infrastructure of the conference on time and the pressures that has been put on the traffic systems, which already has a lot of pressure as it's a very busy city. There's tens of thousands of people coming from across the world with very different privileges, you know, and very different needs, and the city has been still extremely welcoming. However, the conference venue itself has had quite a few challenges with pavilions that didn't have any electricity, so that, like the Moana Pacific Pavilion, for example, had to cancel a few of the events, etc. And hopefully, we'll see how it unfolds actually in the next few days.
Yeah, Shiva, look, there's thousands of delegates there, but there's been an absence, though, with our Pacific leaders. I think from our count, only Serengal Whips Jr. from Palau and just James Marape from Papua New Guinea. Why do you think this is the reason, or that there is a reason for the declining numbers?
Yes, so I think the heads of states, there's low numbers, but some ministers are also turning up. It's challenge, especially to travel to Beleng itself. For example, one of the Palau delegates had to take 7 flights and 3 days just to get there.
Wow.
The cost of accommodation, the cost of just traveling to this space and then spending 2.5 to 3 weeks first, and then the travel back and forth, another extra 6 days, just takes a lot of time away from Pacific government leaders who have to be at home also to be present for their communities and for their country.
Mm. Now, I want to head to US because, you know, they've pulled out of the Paris Agreement, and we know that the UNFCCC process. Does it mean, I don't know, that is there any point in coming to COP anymore if the world's biggest economy is no longer party to it?
The US has traditionally been blockers, you know, in this process. So sometimes not having them in this process actually helps a lot of the discussions because the blocking tactics are not present. However, it's a bit more seriously concerning the tactics that they have recently started taking in the multilateral processes. They withdrew themselves from the Paris Agreement. They have withdrawn themselves from the convention. But they are using bullying tactics and threatening behaviors. Example, the recent International Maritime Organization's Net Zero Framework decision where they threatened certain countries on their visa status, on putting trade tariffs onto them. And this creates a little bit of a fear in this environment. However, if you think about it, the rest of the United Nations are present because they want to at least put their thoughts and their minds to a system that they think it's working, a multilateral environment. And that is what's more important. You know, we have one country that's not there, but we've got 190-something countries that are still present because they want to ensure that we have a future that is climate just and brings about the right things for the climate vulnerable nations across the world.
Mm. Well, yeah, let's get into day one then. What was that like at COP? Do we know if discussions on fossil fuel reductions begun at all?
Day one has been quite chaotic, to be fair. There's been heavy rain, long lines. There's been unfinished building sections, extremely expensive food, etc. But I think the negotiators are trying to get things started as soon as possible. And that was visible with the adoption of the agenda, which sometimes takes a couple of days to come to fruition. You know, so the pre-sessions already had discussions around fossil fuels. But in the main session, it hasn't really had the space yet to discuss as there hasn't been many sessions of negotiations present. However, President of Brazil, President Lula, made a statement today, and fossil fuels was present in his statement, but he countered it with mentioning a lot of sustainable fuels, which is not the solution the world needs to address the climate crisis. You know, we need a clean, a truly green and a just way to try and transition away from fossil fuels.
And, of course, is that in line then with what Greenpeace wants out of this year's COP?
Yeah, Greenpeace has quite a few things because we're a global organization and we've got national regional offices across the world. But in terms of Greenpeace Australia Pacific, we have a very clear asks around this. One is around the 1.5 degrees and limiting it to taking decisions at this COP that ensures that we come back to the 1.5 degrees because this means a lot for a lot of people across the world. It is a matter of survival. It is a matter of people losing lives, children not speaking their own languages because, you know, like Tuvalu, they may have to slowly sign away their futures in a country that only speaks English, huge amounts of displacement, intense storms, etc. So there's so many things that is a matter of survival for our Pacific region if we don't keep it to 1.5 degrees. So Greenpeace is one of our key things is around keeping global temperatures to 1.5 degrees. But then there's also the finance that is necessary to do this. And we, a crisis like the fossil, that they are the ones who are responsible for this and they need to put the money on the table so that climate vulnerable communities can adapt to the climate crisis, but also the world can transition away from fossil fuels.
And how much do you expect that to sort of change or be implemented? Is this a 3-year plan, a 5-year plan? What does that actually look like, Shiva?
Yeah, so currently we've got blocking countries, you know, in this process. But we've got a a grouping that the Pacific is very proud to be part of, which is called the Alliance of Small Island States. And they are holding the line on this 1.5 degrees Celsius. And it's not a one-year thing. It's not a three-year thing. It's for years to come. But we have to do it as soon as possible, because any decimal point above the 1.5 degree threshold and any overshoot above that means, like I said previously, a matter of survival for a lot of climate vulnerable countries across the world. And we can't afford that anymore. So the decisions taken at COP30 may feel like that it is for 1 year or 3 years, but that decision sets a foundation for what comes next, for more ambition that is required from this multilateral process.
Mm. Shiva, I know the other big issue is really COP's next meeting, COP31. Do you expect to maybe see a resolution in that, you know, sort of tussle between Australia and Turkey to host next year's summit?
Yeah, well, they have to decide it at this COP. It has to be decided by the end of this COP. I think that a decision may be coming in the second week. Australia and Turkey is playing head-to-head on this, and neither of them are pulling out. And my position is like most of the Pacific governments, most of the Pacific civil society and communities, that if the COP happens in Australia, although not in the Pacific side of our Moana, and the presidency is with the Pacific, it gives our region the greatest chance to facilitate a space under our conditions, you know, under our ambitions for our people and our communities. But this means that Australia has to allow the Pacific to lead this, to make this a truly Pacific COP and not use our nations and communities as tokenistic colors of the COP. So it's coming to a head right now at this forum. And if it's not decided between the two, it goes to a vote within the grouping that they are, which is the WEOG grouping. And currently Australia thinks that they have the support for this, and if it still doesn't get decided, then it goes to Bonn. You know, like as in, it's so far away from our Pacific. So the ask is that the Australian government really puts their head down at this COP to make sure that they win the bid, not just for Australia but Pacific. But also remember, if it's in the Pacific, the world wins from this.
Which do you think, though, I just have to quickly ask, with Australia wanting to pretty much host next year's summit, would have it had made more of an impact if Australia's Prime Minister came through to COP30?
Definitely. I think it was weak leadership that he didn't travel. He probably has his own thoughts around it, because the president of Turkey, Erdogan, wouldn't be here either. So he feels that there's no point negotiating with ministers or negotiators here rather than the president. So he's sent his team. The minister of climate change will be here, who will have to then, to close the deal out, whichever way it goes. I felt like that this was an opportunity for the Australian government to show that they are really serious about this and send the head of state to travel and be present at this. And the Pacific would have been present here behind him, you know, to push for that. So I felt it was a bit of a weak leadership around this, but it's not the end of the Pacific ambition if the COP is not in the Pacific. The Pacific will still keep fighting, because for us as a region, it's a matter of life and death.
Mm. Shiva, look, that's all the time that we have, and I really do appreciate you joining us this afternoon there from Belim. But all the best for the rest of COP30.
Yeah, vinakavakalevo, and thanks for the opportunity.
No worries. That was the head of Greenpeace Pacific, Shiva Goundon, joining us here on Pacific Beat. But coming up shortly, it is your latest headlines from around the region with our news wrap. Good morning, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoel, and joining me in the studio this morning is our producer, Carl Evans, who brings us the latest headlines around the region. So how are you doing, sir? It's Tuesday.
It is Tuesday, another day in rainy Melbourne. I think we're due for another trip to the Pacific, Aggie.
Look, that just sounds like a plan if the big bosses are listening in. We need more sunshine. We've got some stories, and we're going to start with Nauru, because Australia has actually begun deporting non-citizens back there. What's happening there?
That's right, Aggie. So the first of potentially hundreds of individuals deemed non-citizens by Australia have been removed to Nauru. It's part of that huge multi-billion dollar resettlement arrangement between the two nations that was so controversial earlier this year. So according to RNZ, refugee advocates say they know of at least three men who have already been removed, with eight more detained for deportation under the agreement signed back in August. More interesting, the article also highlighted some of the details of that deportation process. And according to a Refugee Action Coalition spokesperson, it basically commences once Nauru issues an individual, one of the individuals with a visa. That in turn leads to Australian authorities cancelling their visa, then moving to detain them, which is often done in the early hours of the morning. It doesn't sound like a very pleasant process, that's for sure, with people being essentially picked up at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, often on short notice. The Guardian, meanwhile, reported last month that around two dozen people have so far been issued visas as well.
That sounds quite frightening, because that actually reminds me of the dawn raids back in Aotearoa, New Zealand, which would have happened back in the early 70s, 80s, of having to deport our Pacific people back to the islands around that time, early in the morning. So, yeah, that's very, very unfortunate. Okay, well, look, let's get into this. But how many are actually set to be deported under this deal?
So it's about 350 people. They're being targeted under this deal. As I understand it, they're people who have failed character tests to settle in Australia. However, they also can't be sent back to their home country. So they've become known as the NZYQ cohort. It was a nickname that was coined after the 2023 High Court ruling that found keeping them in indefinite detention was unlawful, hence why they've come up with this plan to send them to Nauru. But, you know, it's a 30-year deal, Aggie, so I'm not sure how this is going to be staggered over that period of time, but yeah, it's there nonetheless.
Goodness. Okay. Well, let's head to Vanuatu, because a man has alleged to be selling illegal passports under the country's citizenship program. He's actually evaded authorities.
Yes, yes. The golden passport scheme. It's a story that just keeps on giving in the news business. But a source within the government has revealed to the Daily Post that an Indian national has managed to leave Vanuatu as he was being investigated by police for illegal passport sales. So according to reports, the man is one of Vanuatu's approved agents under the citizenship program. So he was credited to operate illegally, and he operates under the name Vanuatu Sky. Now, there's no details yet on how he was allegedly illegally selling the passports or who he was selling them to. But it appears he knew he was compromised, given that he left the country a week before police raided his residence. According to police, they seized a number of materials, including fake government stamps as well as letterheads. Meanwhile, an even Vanuatu local, also suspected of involvement, has also been arrested and has been banned from leaving Port Vila. Now, as you would know, Aggie, this police investigation comes amid a commission of inquiry into the government's citizenship program. There's been a lot of public concern and criticism being levelled at it, particularly after Andrew Tate was granted a passport. And making matters worse, the man accused is among four certified agents who was under investigation at the moment.
Wow, that is crazy. let's head to some sport then. Time for some rugby league news, because some high-profile PNG players are on the move.
Yeah, a lot's been happening in rugby league lately, Aggie, that is for sure. But one of my favourites, actually a man close to my heart, Morea Morea, is off to the London Broncos for the 2026 Super League season. Follows a very strong end to the Queensland Cup season with the Rockhampton Capras, which culminated in a Pacific Championship selection in which he scored two tries, obviously en route to that Pacific Bowl Championship, the third in a row for the Kumuls. So he's going to team up with his Kumuls teammate, Finlay Blair, in London, and also play under the coach of the Kumuls Pack Championship squad, Jason Demetrio. So you can definitely see where those links meanwhile, PNG Hunters player Judah Rimbu, he's set to join the Brisbane Tigers next year. He actually played in England last year, started the season with the Castleford Tigers, but unfortunately didn't last and due to a lack of playing time, so decided to come back home. But as for Morea Morea, you know, he's had such an up and down career these past couple of years, particularly after getting off to such an incredible start, winning, you know, the Queensland Cup Rookie of the Year about 3 years ago, and then he got that horrible injury, and then he ended up, you know, kind of flaming out of the Hunters, was unable to get a game last year, then went, found his way to the Central Coast in a trade and then played really well again and then made the Kumuls and now he's in England.
He's really made them.
What a career it's been for him so far. Oh, and actually, Aggie, before we go, I just do want to point out that one of the other headlines I did read today, Dean Mariner for Samoa, he has come out on record. He absolutely scored that try on the stroke of half time against the Kiwis,
Have you seen the footage, though? What did you think when you saw
it? Oh, yeah, look, I got to say, I thought it was a try. I was very surprised when that one was disallowed. Usually you give the benefit of the doubt in that scenario, and I thought that was a real. I think had the referee initially called it a try, they wouldn't have overturned it. But I think because the referee had initially said no try, that's why it wasn't allowed. Probably that was the point in the match where I think it really turned in a lot of ways.
Yeah, things sort of did sort of flip upside down after that. But hey, shout out to Dean Mariner for coming out and saying what he needed to say. But as always, Kyle, we appreciate you coming through and giving us our latest headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
Well, look, let's do a quick recap of the show. Violent clashes between students and members of the public in Goroka PNG has actually left more than 50 people injured. Thankfully, no deaths. There's also the climate conference, COP30. It's underway with a notable absence of Pacific leaders. And coming up on the show, it's known as the Red Pigeon. That's right, it's a medical plane giving life-saving service to those in Vanuatu. And it's the 30th Asia-Pacific Forum, and they are highlighting the role and action of human rights across the region. All that and more here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia rana and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, it's known as the Red Pigeon to locals in Vanuatu's Toba province. But for the past 2 years, the life-saving service provided by the plane has been absent. Following extensive repairs, the Red Pigeon is once again flying. Leia Lonbu with more.
The Wings of Hope medical plane landed at Gawa Airport to a warm ceremony, 2 years after it was badly damaged by Cyclone Trudy and Kevin in 2023. The small plane, owned by Dr. Mark and Naomi Turnbull, provides medical evacuation and emergency services to remote locations with no domestic flights. Dr. Turnbull often shares stories of his rescue work on his Facebook page.
Because we're in a place that's geophysically very fragmented, it's very hard to get around in our province. We need wings.
Folks, I cannot believe it. I just came back from Mota Island. This is a remote bush airstrip. Picked up another diabetic ulcer. We are getting inundated with so many diabetic ulcers. This should not be the case. This is a remote place.
Please pray for Alex. She's a young girl from Marilava, on her way to Villa for follow-up for a potentially life-threatening orthopedic condition.
Please pray for my little friend AP, who fell on a bush knife and ended up with some major damage internally. We brought him all the way to Port Villa.
Please pray for KW. She's a very young lady, pregnant, very serious complications in pregnancy. I had to evacuate her and take her to Santo for follow-up care and treatment.
That was Dr. Mark Turnbull reporting on some of the medical emergencies he's attended. Mika Albi is a reporter from Vanuatu Broadcasting in Toba Province.
Well, doctor, I've been stopped a lot.
During the time when the plane was away for repairs, it was also a period when Air Vanuatu was facing challenges. People had to charter flights during emergencies, with planes already used by other provinces too. Sometimes emergency flights couldn't happen because the planes were already booked. People are really happy now that Dr. Mark is back with the plane.
The repairs were funded through community donations and the layman ministry in the United States. President of Torba Province, Edgar Howard, says the community is relieved to see the plane back in service.
We are very, very, very happy to welcoming back to our Red Pigeon after so long. So we thank Flying Doctor, and we thank also some of the funding partners and all partners who joined Flying Doctor to repair the Red Pigeon.
He says health resources remain a challenge in Torba, and the province is seeking more national government support.
Context for the Torba province is totally different from the other province in Vanuatu. Torba province have only some dispensary or health center, and now we have the mini hospital in Sola, but there is no doctor. And 11,000 people in Torba province depend so much with Flying Doctor medical service, but we're still looking for the national government to assist, provincial government to assist more, improve the Flying Doctor service in the banks.
The return of the Wings of Hope plane once again connects Torba's scattered islands to life-saving medical care.
And that report from Pacific Beat's Leah Loanbu.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The president of the Papua New Guinea Rugby Union, Paul Siwi, says he is prepared to resign if it means ending the impasse with Oceania Rugby, which has dragged on for more than a year. PNG remains suspended from the regional body amid accusations of compliance failures, and as a result, its teams have been barred from international competition since last September. Mr. Siwi says he doesn't know why the union's suspension has been extended for a second time, but he believes he has become a personal target for Oceania Rugby. As a result, he says he's ready to stand down within weeks if that means defusing the situation and saving rugby union in PNG from falling even further behind rugby league.
The first time they gave us an ultimatum to have an AGM. So we complied and we had an AGM. 3 months after we had an AGM, they wanted us to have another AGM. So it seems that they have been dictated by some factions here in PNG. So I didn't want to comply with the second direction because it's just administratively not right.
What about the situation regarding audited accounts, which I think was one of the other things they were looking for from you? Have those accounts been delivered?
We had 2 more years of audit to be done. We are working on it, but I'm not keen on doing this because the game is important. The people who play the game are important. I should let it go and, you know, I resign, and maybe somebody of their choice comes in and be in charge of rugby and it'll move again. If people don't appreciate what I do, then there's no point in me being around.
So do you see what's happened, and this has dragged on for over a year now, as something personal? Do you feel that it's personally motivated against you?
Yeah, I think it's something personal against me, so I should let it go. I should not hold on to the job. It's not a private business.
You have raised this prospect before, though, I think, of standing down.
Yes, I did, and I think I raised it with somebody from World Rugby who's talking to us right now. Hopefully, he will hear some news that I have resigned from the job, and we'll have the board reconvene and then appoint a new president.
But this whole situation seems to have been shrouded in mystery from the beginning. There doesn't seem to be any clarity as to exactly what it is you as a union may have done wrong, or exactly what it is Oceania Rugby wants you to put right.
I think we have factions of people who have been in rugby before. They don't want to move on. They still influence Oceania Rugby, so Ocean Rugby is taking this stance against PNG Rugby, so that's okay. We just need to let it go and move on. Turn all everybody to ransom on this.
At the time that the ban was first introduced, you suggested that the PNG Rugby Union had been sabotaged by the president of one of your member organisations, and you also said there was a police investigation. Now, did that police investigation ever come to anything?
Like in PNG, things just don't work out right, so it's one of those things.
So I take it, therefore, the police didn't find anything, or did they just not pursue the investigation in the end?
The investigation didn't go forward.
Do you believe that you, as president of the union, have done anything wrong?
No, I've not done anything wrong. It's all there in the books.
So as far as you're concerned, the answers that Oceania Rugby have been seeking for over a year now are all there for them. For whatever reason, the connection just hasn't been made yet.
It's all there for them. I'm pretty sure that after I resign, they will lift the suspension. The suspension is just for me. It's never the organization. It's personal.
So after all this, and a ban which has been enforced for over a year now and likely to be enforced for at least a little while longer, what has been the impact on the sport of rugby union in Papua New Guinea? Because, of course, you can't compete internationally, which is a big blow, but is it affecting the domestic game too?
Of course. You know, the domestic game, there needs to be some all of activity. We're running a game inside Papua New Guinea, which is predominantly rugby league. So we have a lot of work to do. But when we don't do what we're supposed to do, rugby league picks up the best from our side, and they're playing in the rugby league teams. What can we say? We are placed in a very challenging situation and we have to run the game.
And, of course, during the period where this ban has been in force, famously, the NRL franchise has been awarded to PNG. They will have a side in the NRL from 2028. So the gulf between your code and the league code has got a lot wider in the last 12 months.
That's what Ocean Rugby didn't realise. To challenge rugby league in PNG, it's difficult. When you're getting all the money and all the support and we're supposed to progress, the fight is killing the sport here in this country.
Are you genuinely concerned that a national PNG side might not take to the field again?
PNG side must take the field again because rugby is a big sport. It's bigger than any of us. And it's a good sport for PNG. We have talent, pool of talent here that we need to export. This personal interest and personal attachment to the game is costing us the sport.
So just to reiterate, your intention is to step away from the PNG Rugby Union altogether quite soon, by the sound of it, and then allow someone else to step into the breach and hopefully revive the sport. Is that the plan?
Yes. And when that happens, what I would like to see happen is that there must be an intercity competition, a national competition that will be like rugby league.
And that's the president of the PNG Rugby Union, Paul Siwi. And he was talking to Richard Hewitt on the line from Port Moresby. Pacific Beat has approached Oceania Rugby for a response to Paul Siwi's claims, but we are yet to receive a reply. Now we head to Fiji, where delegates from 27 human rights bodies and civil society groups are meeting at the 30th Asia-Pacific Forum. The forum is aimed at strengthening the role and work of human rights institutes across the Asia-Pacific region. So joining us on Pacific Morning this morning, is the President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, Hugh de Gretser. Welcome, Hugh.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. Look, for some of our listeners who may not know or are aware of Asia Pacific Forum, I'd love if you could just break that down a little bit for us this morning. And why is the Australian Human Rights Commission there this week?
Yeah, so the Asia Pacific Forum is a forum of 27 national human rights institutions. So these are organizations set up by governments which are independent of government to protect and promote the human rights of people in the respective nation states. So there's 27 in the Asia Pacific region, about 120 around the globe. And the Australian Human Rights Commission, where I work, is the Australian version of that body. And so we meet annually. It was in Bangkok last year. It's in Fiji this year to talk about how we can work better together, lessons, emerging priorities, threats to human rights in our region. And climate change is one of those that's squarely on the agenda for our discussion over the next 3 days.
Yeah, I know that one of the goals of Asia Pacific Forum is really to, you know, strengthen national human rights institutions. But why is this so important?
Human rights are the key to people being able to live well in dignity, freedom and safety. They're global standards that governments have agreed to around the world. And national human rights institutions exist to hold governments accountable to those promises they have made to protect people's human rights. And so we engage in advocacy, we review laws and policies, we conduct education, and we're part of that global network so that these global standards can be upheld across our region and across the world.
Hugh, promoting human rights can maybe sometimes be quite, you know, technical, often legal. Like, how is APF helping to really build that capacity and fill the gap?
Yeah, you're right. education is critical. And what it boils down to is human rights are about basic values like freedom, equality, dignity, respect, thinking of each other, how we treat each other, our responsibility to one another. And so when you look at human rights standards, you have things like our right to life, our right to vote, our right to not be locked up unfairly. And then on the social and economic side, our right to health, housing, education, food, water, and the like. So these are essential things that the global community has got together and said, so that everyone can lead a decent, dignified life. These are the things that governments need to uphold.
Mm. Well, I want to talk about the Australian Human Rights Commission itself. You know, you've recently published a report that actually found that climate change is affecting the human rights of Australians. How then, or how can you explain how the government is failing in its duty to look after Australians?
Yeah, so we published this report. You know, climate change is obviously there's extraordinary scientific consensus around the problem of climate change, and its impacts that are happening now and that will continue to accelerate. We wrote this report really to connect the problem of climate change to the issue of people's human rights, to look at it in a different way in terms of the harm that people will suffer that if we don't take more urgent action to address human rights. And so human rights like our right to life, our right to health, our right to housing, our right to food, water, will all be affected by climate change. Our focus as the Australian Human Rights Commission is on the rights of people in Australia, but obviously this is a global problem, and nations who have contributed least to that global problem will be some of the nations who are hit hardest by it. And so we're in Fiji, the Pacific region with low-lying islands. Will obviously, it's an existential, climate change is an existential threat for communities living on those islands. So it's particularly important for this region, our focus on Australia. Australia's a wealthy, developed nation, but Australia will suffer serious consequences from climate change, and every degree of global warming that we can prevent, we reduce those consequences. So our report says to the Australian government, you have obligations to protect people's rights in Australia, to protect people's human rights. You need to act with greater urgency to reduce fossil fuel consumption and speed up the transition to renewables and protect people's rights in the process.
Mm. Well, Hugh, I mean, that really brings me back to, you know, COP30 is currently underway in Brazil at the moment. Does that then, what's happening over there, have any bearing on the work that APF is wanting to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. This is obviously a global problem that only can be addressed through global cooperation. That's why it's critical that nations like Australia lead on climate change. Australia's per capita one of the biggest consumers of fossil fuels that create the pollution that causes climate change. Australia is also a major exporter of fossil fuels that are burnt in other nations around our region. And so we are a big contributor, 13th largest economy in the world, to the problem of climate change. We need to work with other countries to address that problem. And, you know, Australia's doing some good things, but we're not working fast enough to address the problem of climate change. So we need to urgently speed up that transition from fossil fuels to renewables. We need to strengthen human rights protections. And one of the things we've recommended is implementing a Human Rights Act in Australia that protects in Australian law people's human rights, like I mentioned before, to health, to housing, to life, to an adequate standard of living, which includes things like food and water.
Mm. And I understand, you know, that the International Court of Justice, you know, their decision was called for that set up right of a Human Rights Act in Australia. Again, how important is this for Australia, and how can the government do better to really just protect its people?
Yeah, International Court of Justice was delivered a landmark advisory opinion a couple of months ago. So this was the UN General Assembly said to the court, we want your advice. This is the most important international court. We want your advice about what are the legal obligations under international law of states to address climate change, and what are the consequences if states don't adhere to those obligations. And the court said that those legal obligations arise under a number number of different sources of international law, including international human rights law. And the court said that nation states have a legal obligation to reduce global warming to 1.5 degrees above that pre-industrial level or lower. And if states don't take sufficient action to collectively to achieve that, then nation states like Australia, who are big per capita producers and exporters and consumers of fossil fuels, could be liable to other nations that suffer harm from that process. And obviously, nations in this region, in the Pacific, will suffer the greatest harm.
When we talk about climate change, you know, it has a very disproportional impact on different groups in society, right? But what I found interesting, though, in this report is that why are women and girls more hard hit by climate change?
Yes, so you're right that often a lot of the groups who have contributed least to the problem are most vulnerable to its impacts. And so when you look at, you know, people with disability, older people, children who over their lifetime will bear greater impacts from climate change, women and girls, First Nations communities, Indigenous communities across the region, all of those different groups will bear are particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and often have less capacity to adapt to those impacts. So wealthy developed nations have more ability to respond to those, the harms of climate change. If you're an older person in Australia and you're a greater risk from dying from extreme heat, for example. If you're a person living in poverty, you have less access to better housing, for example, with air conditioning to address the impact of climate change. You're more exposed to rises in fluctuations in energy prices, for example. And so governments really need to look at those particular impacts for particular groups to make sure that they are properly protected from the harms of climate change.
Look, I know that we have to wrap up now, Hugh, but I do appreciate you having to come on the show this morning. Very insightful.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
No worries. That is the President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, Hugh de Gretser, here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Papua New Guinea's largest university has been shut down after violent clashes between students and members of the public left more than 50 people injured.
It happened in around some grandkids. There were arguments between the local community, the Aspis people and students. And then there was a confrontation. And then after that, the students mobilized and they came down and fight with the community there. And then the community, the local Aspis, will retaliate again. And then that's how the situation went out of control.
And that was Max Gotti, longtime Goroka resident. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it's your news. And after that, it is the Boys of Nisha Daily. Until next time, o tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.